I would like to acknowledge our partners, the University of Lethbridge, who distribute the notices to you, to Lethbridge College, who post the audio of these sessions on our website. And we'd also like to thank the new owners of this venue, Country Kitchen, Country Kitchen Catering, for preparing the lunch. And we look forward to sampling their new fare in 30 minutes. The format for today's session is the same as usual. We'll have our speaker make a presentation for 25 to 30 minutes, followed by lunch, and then we'll have, at around 1 o'clock, a little bit before the question and answer session. And our talk today is entitled Right-Wing Nationalism in Japan, The Rise and Fall of Shinzo Abe, who was Japan's Prime Minister for just a year, from 2006 to 2007. The topic may seem somewhat remote to us here in southern Alberta, but in the world of interdependence and connectivity in which we live, the rumblings of militant nationalism in East Asia have been heard even in this peaceful outpost, and they are disquieting. Our speaker today is Trevor Harrison. Dr. Harrison was born and raised in Edmonton and holds a BA from the University of Winnipeg, an MA from the University of Calgary, and a PhD from the University of Alberta. He's currently professor and chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Lethbridge and the interim director of the university's Prentice Institute of Global Demography and Economics. Dr. Harrison is the author or co-author of 6 books examining Alberta and Canadian politics. In the fall of 2006, he and his family traveled to Japan, where they spent the next 4 months. That period in Japan witnessed the election of a new Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, whose right-wing nationalist platform called for changes to Japan's constitution and for a greater role of its military. And that sent shockwaves throughout East Asia, particularly China, but they rippled across to the shores of North America as well. Dr. Harrison had a first-hand view of these events, resulting in the recent publication of his book, 21st Century Japan, A New Sun Rising. And Dr. Harrison's book will be on sale at the end of the session in the lobby. He's generously offered to contribute a percentage of the sales proceeds of his new Japan book to SAGPA, so I would urge you to buy a copy or two or three. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Trevor Harrison.
Well, thank you indeed, Trevor, for that wonderful introduction, and thank you also to SAGPA for inviting me to be here. This is not the first time I've presented here. I was trying to remember. I know I've been here at least twice before, and it may even be 3 times going back over a few years. In the past, I've usually end up talking about Alberta or Canadian politics, so this is a little bit different kind of talk for me, and it's a very different kind of book than I have presented in the past. But I found Japan absolutely fascinating. In fact, I really enjoyed the Japanese people, and I enjoyed learning a good deal about Japan. And one of the things, actually, that struck me in the time I was in Japan is that it's very easy to imagine other places, and particularly a place that is, in some sense, very different from Canada, as Japan is, to be totally different from us, almost kind of like Mars and Venus kind of thing. But what struck me, in fact, and in the summary sections of the book, as you'll find out, at least I hope you'll find out when you buy those 1, 2, 3 copies, is that in many ways Japan is struggling with many of the same kind of issues that Canada is struggling with. Issues such as population itself, changing demographics, changes in terms of the nature of its economy, struggles with the environment. The environment is very much a topical kind of issue in Japan, and of course we know all about the Kyoto Accord that was signed, in fact, in the city of Kyoto. And most particularly, one of the things that Japan is struggling with that is very similar to Canada is its relationship to the United States, an empire that is in fact being diminished in power and influence, but is in, at the same time extremely powerful. And given historic relations, Japan, as Canada, has to pay attention to its relationship with the United States. So my talk today is particularly going to deal with nationalism and militarism, but as I say, the text itself actually deals fairly broadly with some other kinds of comparative things as well. So let me begin the talk, and I'll tell you one of the things actually that I don't know if it's a benefit or not that came out of my time in Japan was I actually started using PowerPoint, so I kind of myself got into the 21st century. And one of the things I've been struggling with, however, is how to present PowerPoint in a way that actually is interesting to people, and at the same time you actually inform people rather than just always giving them a slideshow. I'm just wondering here, is there some way that we can expand this so we get rid of the smaller pictures and we get the full screen here? Do you know which button we need to push here to... One of the things I always tell my students is that sociologists are really horrible with technology, so every time I mess something up in the classroom, that's my excuse. It's great with old television sets that don't work. You just kind of kick it, right? But, you know, it doesn't work for new technologies.
Well, you could kick it, but then you could go into a future shop and wear
it. Don't go to View.
Oh, it's one of these down here. I recognize it. I think it's the middle one at the bottom. One or perhaps there it is. Perfect. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. I'm always saved by the kindness of strangers, as they say, or good friends. Okay. As you've already heard, in the fall of 2006, my wife and son, eventually actually our daughter, came over for a brief period of time to visit us. We went on exchange, and just a promo here for the University of Lethbridge. This is an exchange with Hokkai Gakuin University in Sapporo, Japan. This exchange has been going on for 25 years or more at this point, and it's an excellent way of building relationships between the university, the city of Lethbridge, and Sapporo as well. The pictures on the left are pictures of my son and my wife when we were in a temple in Nara, Japan, which is actually the original capital of Japan, going back some many hundreds of years. And that's myself in a restaurant in Hakodate, which is a city on the island of Hokkaido. I don't know how many people here have perhaps been to Japan, and particularly to Hiroshima at some point. This is a picture of the cenotaph in Hiroshima commemorating, of course, the horrible bombing that occurred in August of 1945. And on the right-hand side, what you see is a building which is referred to as the A-bomb dome. It was a factory, and if you go to the museums in Hiroshima, what you find is that much of the city was entirely flattened. But surprisingly, and this is actually the main point for where the bomb dropped, this particular dome over that was part of the factory actually survived, and so it's a kind of eerie reminder of that event. And it's important to recognize, of course, how the attacks, the bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, still remain in the consciousness of many Japanese people. There is a very strong peace movement there, and it's ensconced, in a sense, in their peace constitution. But what I'm going to talk about is the fact that that peace movement, as large as it is, there is also an element that is extremely militarist and also rejects many of the lessons of the Second World War, and in fact would like to rewrite history as it should be, according to them. As it turns out, and I am a political sociologist, and as I said, I've written a good deal about politics and particularly Canada in the past, I had kind of serendipitously something happened to me almost as soon as I landed in Japan. We landed there on August 30th. The next day, we very quickly went off to Nagasaki. And the day after that, we went to Hiroshima. And that day, we went to the Peace Park, which is, this is where this is located. And as I'm walking up to the Peace Park, we notice a large number of stretch limousines, people with very dark sunglasses who are unmistakably security agents, and a phenomenal number of paparazzi. And so as I'm walking up there, I quickly buttonholed one of the Japanese students who was standing around, and I said, "What's happening?" And he said, "Well, Shinzo Abe is coming, and he's probably going to be the next prime minister of Japan." And, you know, I don't know Shinzo Abe. But I know this is obviously a big event. I mean, it's political. He's going to be prime minister. Who is this person? So as I said, for a political sociologist, this is like having manna fall from heaven. This is quite a wonderful introduction to Japanese politics immediately. And Shinzo Abe, for sure, he arrives just a few minutes later. And as you'll see in the book, actually, this is just one of several pictures, because I did exactly what all the paparazzi was doing. I pulled out my camera and I began snapping shots. So I joined them, you know, future career. So I have pictures in the book of him sequentially moving up to lay the wreath. And this, that fundamentally what this was a photo op to launch his becoming prime minister. Within that day later on, he announced he was going to run, and shortly thereafter, he's elected as prime minister. Beginning this very short, exciting, and important year in Japanese politics. So who is Shinzo Abe? Well, these are a few details about him. He was, in fact, the first Japanese prime minister born after the Second World War. And for many people, they said, well, this is going to be significant, right? We're going to have somebody who is not of the war generation. But curiously enough, in a lot of ways, Shinzo Abe is very much a product of the war, and in fact, pre-war politics. One of the things that is striking about Japanese politics is the kind of incestuous nature of the political elite. Many of the people are, in fact, who have high positions, including being prime minister, are their fathers, grandfathers, as you see here, uncles, were, in fact, also prime ministers. In fact, the current prime minister who replaced Shinzo Abe, his father was a prime minister before as well. And so there's a kind of circulation of the elite structure there. But the most important thing to know about Abe is the name of his maternal grandfather, Nobusuke Kishi. Kishi was arrested at the end of the Second World War as a war criminal. He was in prison for a period of time, but in 1947, in the context of the Cold War, most of the people who were arrested as war criminals were subsequently released. And the reason for this was the United States decided at that point, because Japan was under American administration, decided that the Cold War was more important to win than democracy. And so fundamentally, they released people because they wanted to reconstitute the old elite structure on the side of America and against the threat of communism, socialism, Marxism, or any other variants thereof. And so Japan very quickly underwent a reversion, in a sense, to previous politics. Kishi was always, throughout his lifetime, and eventually did again become prime minister in the late 1950s, he was always an unrepentant war demagogue, if I can put it that way. He constantly denounced the revisionist, as he's viewed it, history of Japanese history, and said that, in fact, Japan was quite justified in going to war and conducting the actions that it did. And Shinzo Abe grew up basically at the foot of his maternal grandfather and took in much of the rhetoric about rebuilding Japanese pride and its military history, including the imperial throne. This is replicated then in Abe's own political history. After he was elected in 1993, he very quickly began to make a name for himself, particularly in wanting to revise Japanese history, and led various movements to write Japanese history again the way that right-wing militarists would like to see Japanese history recorded. This includes wanting to argue that there was no such things as the sex slaves that were basically used by Japanese forces in parts of Korea and other parts of conquered territories. And again, justifying Japan's actions generally throughout the Second World War. He rises very quickly in the administration, in fact ends up being finally groomed under the Koizumi government to become prime minister. One of the books he, a book he brings out in 2006 is also kind of an attempt to launch his bid for being prime minister. It's called Toward a Beautiful Nation, and the main point of the book is really a call for a return to Japan in its pre-war sense. So a traditional, a return to traditional relationships, hierarchical relationships, where males dominate females, where the status that you're born into is the status that you are going to remain in, and again, a return to the kind of cultural and political mores of the pre-war period. One important thing to realize in the context of Japanese history, many of you certainly may know this, is Japan has undergone some pretty fundamental transformations in the last 150 some years. They have been pushed quite often by external forces. In the mid part of the 19th century, the context of the rise of free trade, as we would think of it today, American, British, French, Russian, and other powers went in and forced Japan to open up its ports and to engage in free trade. That is, we're going to give you the great benefits of free trade at the point of a gun. The result of this was Japan did undergo a fundamental transformation. The subsequent Meiji period saw Japan rapidly industrialize, but it kept many of its political and cultural structures. It remained highly hierarchical and quite militarist. And part of this was a desire after that initial defeat, that intrusion by Western powers, to restore Japanese pride. It is, one can't overemphasize the degree to which the sense of hurt pride from Western actions motivates, has motivated in the past and continues to motivate some people in Japan today, particularly on the right. This was followed, of course, at the end of the Second World War by the administration of General MacArthur and the Allied powers. Once again, for some people in Japan, the sense that they had been humiliated and a desire to rectify this. The Second World War does lend itself to the creation of new political alliances. One thing important thing to note here is that the pre-war structure was in some sense replicated and very much at the with the urging of the American government. That is, the old corporatist structure, a kind of tight linking between the political and corporate elite, was replicated. And so companies such as Mitsubishi and others that were large corporations in the pre-war era simply morphed themselves into large corporations in the post-war era. And again, much of the elite structure is replicated. Unions are basically reduced in power, and the only unions that really exist in Japan are fundamentally company unions. They're ones that companies allow, not independent. The United States does exercise far more control than they would have in the pre-war period. The Japanese governments of the period actually do something very clever in retrospect, and it lays the basis for Japanese economic growth. The Americans want bases in the context of the Cold War. The Japanese government under Shigeru Yoshida, who's probably the most important prime minister of the post-war period, says, okay, you can have the bases, but we want something in return, and that is we want open access to American markets. The fact that the United States actually ends up becoming de facto the defender of Japanese territory is a wonderful economic boon for Japan, because they don't have to put money into the military. Quite frankly, the military is an incredible sop for all kinds of money, and it's a waste. As the United States is discovering, and as I fear Canada is going to discover if we keep going down the path that we're currently doing. We're going to put a ton of money into the military and nothing into our social infrastructure or building the things we need for the 21st century. Japan was saved from this. They were saved from this by the United States, and they were also saved from this by their own constitution, which fundamentally limits the size and the role of the Japanese military, basically to being a purely defense force, no further foreign engagements. What holds this alliance together is the Liberal Democratic Power Party, and it's in power from 1955 to 1993. I suspect the conservatives in Alberta may eventually challenge this record for longevity here, but it's an impressive record. So how do they actually go about doing this? There are six sources for the LDP's dominance during this period of time. One is a simply traditional customs of deference to authority, but as I've urged people in past talks, we have to remember here that deference is quite often accompanied with a good deal of coercion. People are, in fact, frightened to challenge. American interference, we also know from State Department documents that the Americans' State Department for a long period of time was giving large amounts of money to the LDP. Covertly to bolster its support. Disproportionate weighting of rural votes, that is, rural voters tend to disproportionately support the LDP in the political system, recognize that, the voting system. The bureaucracy in Japan became incredibly politicized and is in fact a arm of the LDP. Finally, the two other things, the economic resurgence of the 1950s supported people don't tend to vote against governments when they're doing really well economically, and that was the case in Japan. And finally, the left wing in Japan was largely fragmented. Why did the LDP decline? Well, if we were to focus on any one thing, it's a severe recession that begins in the 1980s but really takes hold in the 1990s. This is the lost decade for Japan, and frankly, it hasn't really come out of this yet. Economic growth there is 1.5 to 2%. Growing levels of poverty, homelessness is a regular story in most Japanese newspapers. There's a real sense of depression, hopelessness that has been revealed in a number of polls among Japanese people. The result is the LDP goes down to defeat in 1993. There are a series of coalition governments for a period of time afterwards, but finally the LDP comes back again. Comes back in the form of Prime Minister Koizumi, who is in office for the next number of years until Abe takes over as his successor in 2006. So what does Abe actually do here? There are three areas that particularly I want to concentrate on here. In terms of nationalist policies and more particularly militarist policies, one, he changes the education system. The education system is designed to encourage much more loyalty to the nation and the state, and to get away from Western notions of individualism. And many view this as a return to the old pre-war imperial call that you lay down your life for the Japanese nation. The second thing, he raises the profile of the defense agency to a full ministry and begins to probe the possibilities of Japan's military being more active in the world. But to do this, he also has to change the peace constitution. I will skip a couple of these here and just leave this up for a second. This is actually Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. You can read it. This is one of the most famous parts of the Japanese Constitution. Basically, it prohibits the Japanese military from engaging in foreign operations. And Abe's intent in changing the Constitution was clearly that the military would take a more enlarged role in the world with sending troops to various places. This scared much of Asia, one can't overemphasize the fear and historical memory that most parts of Asia have towards Japanese military actions in the past. The government did pass a law to amend the Constitution. I'll skip by that very quickly here. So what are the aims of right-wing nationalism and militarism? In some sense, to freeze and even to turn back Japan, to turn back from the late part of modernization. They like industrialization, they like those things, but the right wing wants a much more hierarchical, militarist approach. To rewrite history as it should have been, to reassert Japanese leadership in Asia. And this is a contest that Japan and China have historically fought out. Japan sees itself losing its position to China and wants to reassert itself, at least the right wing of the country does. And finally, much of this must be understood, however, as an attempt by the LDP, in the absence of doing anything real to address Japan's problems, to deal in kind of symbolic change. We're going to be nationalistic, and suddenly that solves all your real problems of the environment, a declining economy, an aging population, etc., etc. Governments love to engage in symbolic things when they're afraid to take on anything really meaningful. So why now? The economic crisis. The LDP's fragmentation, frankly, has allowed extreme right-wing elements to gain more power in the party than it would have in the past. The rise of China does scare also some people within Japan. American weakness. America's declining influence throughout the world, and particularly Asia, opens the possibilities for Japan to rethink its relationship to the rest of the world. And finally, cultural tensions, the consequences of modernity. For many on the right, they are concerned about individualism, consumerism, what they view as kind of sexual excess. Everything to do with modernity or even postmodernity is something anathema to the right wing in Japan. Abe resigns. He's replaced by Yasuo Fukuda, who is a compromise candidate. Again, he's 72, 73 years old, and he's in real trouble right now, as Abe was. That's because the political system in Japan is not currently able to address the fundamental problems again. So what lies in future? Well, the crisis continues. And it's not clear right now that there's any political party that would gain support. You'll note here these are the results from a recent poll in Japan in the Japan Times Online. 25% support for Fukuda's cabinet, 60% disapproval rate, but note here support for the LDP is at 26%, and support for the major opposition party is 22%, so it doesn't have any great support either. What is of interest is going to happen is there has been talk just in the last little while of some members of the LDP, presumably younger members, and some members of the other Japanese parties getting together to create a new political party that will get Japan out of the logjam, perhaps, we would hope, drive it in a direction away from militarism and extreme nationalism to really fundamentally dealing with the problems that do face Japan. Lovely pictures of Nakajima Park in Sapporo to finish off with. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Trevor. And now we'll have lunch for about 20 minutes, and then we'll come back to our question and answer period.